From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Natan Sharansky, the Soviet refusenik who was imprisoned for 9 years before he was allowed to emigrate to Israel. Freedom has its perils, too. He's constantly besieged by journalists and activists, and he says resisting his friends is sometimes harder than resisting his enemies. Also today, I speak with Mark Morris, one of the most sought-after choreographers and dancers in America and Europe. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album from guitarist Joshua Breakstone. And television critic David Bianculli looks at the durability of the laugh track. Just as the laugh track is fading on sitcoms, it's popping up on commercials. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. During the 9 years Anatoly Sharansky was locked up in Soviet prisons and labor camps, the authorities never broke his will. He refused to offer information or sign false confessions. Sharansky was a leader of the movement to allow Soviet Jews to emigrate to Israel. He applied for an exit visa in 1973 when he was 25 years old. Sharansky was also a founding member of the Helsinki Watch Group, a group of refuseniks and dissidents who documented human rights violations in the Soviet Union. Sharansky was arrested by the KGB in 1977 and convicted of treason and espionage. His wife, who had emigrated to Israel, began an international campaign for his release. He became a symbol of Soviet anti-Semitism. When Soviet authorities released him from prison and expelled him from the country in 1986, he joined his wife in Israel. There he changed his name to Natan. Natan Sharansky has just written a book about his imprisonment in the Soviet Union. It's titled Fear No Evil. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. Sharansky writes that he grew up in the Soviet Union unaware of Jewish culture, history, and religion. I asked him if there was a turning point when he started to feel he wanted to become more Jewish.
For me, I was always aware that I'm Jewish simply because there was a word in my identification card of my parents, and as a Jew, and as a result, you were subjected to anti-Semitism. So my Jewishness for me, as for all other Jews of my generation, had very negative meaning, that you are Jewish because there is anti-Semitism. I think the first time when you really realized that it can be also the source of pride was 1967, when the victory of Israel against their enemies who tried to destroy it changed the atmosphere, and suddenly you see that even anti-Semites who probably treat you with the same hatred at the same time have much more respect to you. And suddenly you understand that that state is struggling not only for its right to exist, but also for your dignity. And you want to know more about that people, that history, that culture which unites you with that state.
Once you applied to emigrate to Israel, and once you became an activist, did you expect to be imprisoned?
Well, of course, every person in the Soviet Union who expresses any views, national, religious, political, ethical, which are not approved by the authorities, if he's not too naive or too stupid, must understand that he can be a victim of the regime. And, of course, the moment you started openly to struggle for your right to leave, and when you became a spokesman of the movement, Jewish immigration movement, and this is the moment I had to realize that every day I can be arrested.
You were one of the founders of the Helsinki Watch Group, and this was a group that united both refuseniks and human rights activists. Do you think that your arrest was in part a way to discourage the alliance between Jewish refuseniks and other dissidents trying to create reform within the Soviet Union?
Well, definitely. The KGB doesn't like all types of such alliance. Before arrest, and especially in prison, I saw many times how KGB was using different tactics to make splits between dissidents of different nationalities or religions. Probably it was one of the arguments to arrest me, but I don't think that it was the main argument. The main argument, of course, was to destroy our Jewish immigration movement, to demonstrate that it's part of world Zionist plot against Soviet Union, and on the other hand, to destroy Helsinki watch groups, to paralyze attempts of dissidents to check sincerity of Soviet Union in fulfilling their obligations on human rights.
Natan Sharansky is my guest, and he's written a new book about his imprisonment in the Soviet Union titled Fear No Evil. When you were imprisoned, your wife had already emigrated to Israel, and she started an international movement for your release. As badly as you were treated in prison, do you think you would have been treated worse had there not been an international group of people campaigning for your release?
Not only I think so, I'm sure that we have a lot of examples that our fate in Soviet prisons depends fully from the readiness of public opinion of the world to struggle for us. I'll give only one little example. Being in strong confrontation with authorities when they didn't let me to write letters home in prison, I started a hunger strike. And after 110 days of this hunger strike, when I was almost dying, in the last moment they retreated, met my demands, and permitted me to write letters to my mother and my wife. Exactly in the same prison, in the same conditions, with the same hunger strike, 2 years after me, in the times of Gorbachev, 3 years after me, Russian dissident Anatoly Marchenko, my friend, died as a result of the hunger strike. In this case, authorities were much less concerned about public opinion, about reaction of the world, and they permitted him to die, what they couldn't permit me to do.
It would have made them look bad if you died in prison.
Well, they were afraid of the possible complications and consequences of this in the world. And of course, it was a direct result of the struggle which my wife, with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people all over the world, was leading.
When you were in prison, you were given a couple of opportunities to get out. One would have been to make a false confession. And the other was you were offered the opportunity to go out saying that you'd petitioned for health reasons, and you didn't do that either. Let me ask you about the first one. You could have, given a false confession, and then once you got out, recanted and say that you gave that confession just to get out of prison. Why didn't you ever consider doing something like that?
Yes, in the first months of investigation, they were showing me many examples of foreigners and dissidents who, from their point of view, made the right thing, who confessed, then were released, then went abroad and said that all this was wrong. And they were almost pushing me to do this. Why? Because for them, the man who accepted their lies, who became again slave, refused from his right to be free man, is not dangerous. And when I was thinking all this situation, I understood that there are some reasons why, rational reasons, why I cannot do it. First of all, by this I compromise my friends and who will go on this way after me, and my weakness will make them weaker. Second, I will compromise those people in the West who support us, because the only reason why they support, because we have moral power, very strong moral position. And if I help the KGB to destroy this moral position, I compromise also those who support us in the West. And of course, I make easier for KGB to prepare new cases against dissidents. But at the same time, I could always understand that even if these reasons wouldn't exist, or if I somehow could find solution for all these reasons, there was some irrational resistance to make principal compromises with the KGB. I understood that the moment you start compromising with them on this, you again become slave, as I was many years ago. When as a loyal citizen, I had to think one thing, but to say another thing. And since I became free, I didn't want that. I wanted to remain a free person even in Soviet prison.
During the 9 years that you were in prison, you constantly resisted through hunger strikes, through refusing to confess to things that they asked you to confess to. What did you have to find in yourself to find that power to always resist?
Well, I think the most important thing was that I knew the difference between the life of a slave, whom I was a loyal Soviet citizen, and living in double thinking all the time, to say one thing and to do another thing, and to think the third thing, and the life of a free person who says what he thinks, who does what he believes is decent. And since you know this difference, and since you as long as you understand that what KGB in fact wants from you is to turn you back to this life of the slave, and you know that you don't want that life which they propose to you, and that's almost enough. Of course, to resist for all these years, you must build your own world in Gulag, in which you're really free, and to bring in this world all the most important memories of the past, to bring in this world all your all the things to which you got accustomed to, whether it is playing chess in your mind, or whether it's some scientific speculations, or whether it's literary heroes and so on, and to bring them and to make them to work for you. Of course, so and to protect yourself with the help of irony. But what's important to understand that then Gulag, I as well as other political prisoners, did have our world of freedom. And that's what was helping us to resist to the KGB, who was trying to destroy this world and to turn us into slaves again.
The world of freedom that you had was the mental freedom that you had to think and say what you wanted?
Yeah, mental, spiritual, that's the real freedom.
The impression I get from your book is that one of your great tools or even weapons was your wit and your sense of humor. And I want to just read an excerpt from your book. And this is this takes place in prison. And you write, "One day I received a visit from Lieutenant Colonel Malafive, the head of the prison. 'You must behave better,' he told me, 'or we'll keep you here in the punishment cell.' 'What's wrong with the punishment cell?' I said. 'Someday I'll go to Israel, and people will ask me about the punishment cell in Christopol prison. I must be able to answer them.' 'That's exactly why we must keep you in prison,' he replied, the colonel replied. 'You're always thinking of bad things to say about us to the West.' 'What bad things?' I said. 'Are you saying that conditions in Soviet prisons are bad? That sounds like slander.'" That's the kind of typical back-and-forth conversation that you had with people in prison, kind of wordplay and changing things to make it seem like, oh, that they were saying bad things about the prison. Did that help you, being able to
of
do
course,
that?
I think that is one of the most powerful weapons in dealing with KGB. The moment you start dealing with them too seriously, the moment when you treat them too seriously, the moment when the only emotion which you express is anger and you start shouting at them, you become too close to them, too involved in their work with you. So you all the time, it's very important to keep them on distance, to feel not only that you are simply the toy in their hands, but you are almost the director of all this, what's happening, that you can always dictate your own rhythm, and that you can simply laugh on them. And that's so important, that it helps you to live in different world from them and to separate yourself from them. I think that without this, it could be much more difficult for me to survive and to be so strong.
Do you know why you were released?
Nobody can say why. I think if you mean what was the last drop which made Soviet Union to make this decision. But no doubt that I would never be released if there was not such a powerful, strong campaign all over the world, and if before going to prison, I wouldn't marry such a woman as my wife.
I want to talk more with you about your life and your life after prison, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Natan Sharansky, and he's written a book about his imprisonment in the Soviet Union. It's titled Fear No Evil. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Natan Sharansky is my guest. He was a leader in the Soviet movement for human rights and for Jewish emigration. He was sent to prison and became the focus of a major international movement calling for his release. After 9 years, he was expelled from the country in 1986 and emigrated to Israel. He's written a book about his imprisonment titled Fear No Evil. I think about you going to Israel after your long imprisonment, and it was a place that you had looked forward to living in for so many years. You thought of it as as a place that you wanted to be your home. But when you got there, you really didn't speak the language, Hebrew, and you really didn't know that much about how the Jewish religion was practiced, because you hadn't had the opportunity to actually practice it while you lived in the Soviet Union. I find that an incredible paradox in a way, and I wonder what it was like if you felt both kinship and alienation when you first got to Israel.
Well, I definitely didn't feel any alienation. From the very first moment, I felt that I came home, home in the narrow sense to my wife, and now also we have daughter, but also in the broader sense, that I felt that we are here in Israel like one big family. But of course, people who are dreaming about paradise, and when they really come to paradise, I suspect, find out that it's not exactly that place which they imagined. The reality is always different from the dreams, but I cannot say that much more complicated, but I can say that it's less attractive.
In Israel, I think you've felt really divided between devoting your time to your family and to just living your life again and remaining an activist. How have you resolved those poles on your life between family life and activism?
I don't think that I succeeded to resolve this problem fully up to now, but one of the first things which we did, we tried to build high wall between us and the correspondents who wanted to interview us day and night. And I think that, and not only correspondents, but many other people, each of whom wanted piece of us, and it was, I think that many people were maybe angry, were upset, were disappointed, but with the time they understood that we also have the right for our own life. At the same time, I felt from the very first moment, and I feel it up to now, that I cannot be really free and enjoy freedom until those whom I left behind are not free, that we can become free only together. And that's why we, so much time we have to spend out of Israel, traveling all over the world, trying to mobilize people on the struggle to help our brothers in Soviet Union. And my wife, who, since I was released, prefers not to travel, understands it and supports it.
There are several different branches of Judaism. When you were free to actually practice Judaism in Israel, did you want to get a sense of what all the options were before deciding how you were going to practice it, and whether you would be Orthodox or conservative, you know, how you would practice it?
Well, I don't. Living in Israel, it's much less problem than for Jewish life in Israel. It's much less problem than for Jewish life in other places. Everything is, for me, is so integral there and so natural that, of course, I do want to know more about Jews, Jewish life, Jewish religion, and I have meetings with all directions, with representatives of all streams of our Jewish religious life. But I don't feel myself torn apart into different directions. I simply do what is already natural to me to do and don't do what's still not natural. And I try to study step by step a little bit Judaism, the things which I couldn't study before. And if you ask me to what stream I'll belong, I wouldn't be even able to say to you. I think I don't have a need in formalizing this.
Your wife, on the other hand, has become very Orthodox. She had become that while you were in prison. I know there's been a lot of speculation that that could possibly cause tension in the relationship. On the other hand, I know of so many people who are of two different religions altogether. So clearly people can live together with different ways of practicing a religion. So are you both practicing differently, and does that seem perfectly comfortable?
All the problems which are supposed to exist in our family exist only in the newspapers and sometimes on the radio. They don't exist in our real life. And one maybe of the upsetting things when you came to the free world was why so many people don't even think that it is impossible for two people who love one another, who get their energy, enthusiasm, power, force from the same source, and only because the ways in which they express their feelings are slightly different, why it can cause problems, why such people cannot live peacefully in one family, in one country, and in one world. And for me, who came from the Soviet Gulag, where we lived in one cell, people of different nationalities, of different religions, of different backgrounds, and sometimes of even different aims, and nevertheless could find a common language and could cooperate together in our struggle with evil, it's especially upsetting that you come to the free world and find out that here people understand tolerance sometimes much less than in the Soviet camp.
Natan Sharansky is my guest. Israel is a very, very complicated country, and it's seen by some as being the oppressed and by others as also being the oppressor. I know you are always asked questions about Palestinian rights. You grew up in the Soviet Union and really understood the politics of that country. Being a newcomer to Israel and being constantly asked questions about the politics of Israel, do you feel comfortable becoming a spokesperson, being so new to the country?
Well, that's why I'm so... my experience in Gulag cannot be compared with my experience in Israel life. That's why I'm so careful in taking position on one another question in the Israel life, and try not to be a spokesman of the issues which I feel I don't still understand very deeply. But one of the things to which I resist always is that automatic parallel which many people make in their questions by comparing the plight of Soviet Jews in Soviet Union, the plight of Arabs in Israel, saying that, in fact, it's the same type of oppression, the same type of human rights problem, and so on. With all my understanding and sometimes sympathy to those involuntary victims of the situation in Israel, I have to say that there is absolutely no parallel between totalitarian state, which is trying to destroy individual, which views that individual is part of the state's property, and democratic society with all its democratic institutions, free press, opposition, parliament, elections, and so on, trials, open trials, and so on, which faces really serious dilemma. It's how to defend its right to exist, how to defend itself in the war against terror, and at the same time, how, in those complicated historical situations in which it is, to not to destroy those fundamental principles on which the state was built, and to guarantee human rights to every citizen. And that's the serious challenge which our society really faces.
I believe that a lot of Palestinians have approached you asking you for your understanding and for your support. Do you give them an audience when Palestinians come to you and ask you to hear out their case?
I'll tell you more, that I myself, on my own initiative, approached some of those who were known as moderate Palestinian leaders, and we had some private meetings, and private not only because publicity can harm to this, but but also because when they really said something moderate, and they were saying, why with this point or that point you wouldn't go publicly to Jerusalem Post or some other place, and we'll start at least discussion. I can't say that I agree with this, but we can start discussion. The answer was very sad, that if I tell it publicly what I say you now, tomorrow I'll be killed by one or another extremist from Syria, or the one who'll get orders here in eastern Jerusalem and so on. And that's, I think, the biggest tragedy of Palestinian people, and as the result of us, that during 70 years of this coexistence, those Palestinian leaders who had really courage to say we have to accept their right to exist, we must start negotiations, as a rule, all of them were really killed.
Last week in the Soviet Union, dissident Andrei Sakharov held a press conference in which he praised Perestroika, he praised Gorbachev, and he said that Gorbachev's reform policies were deserving of trust. He also said that his public statement, that Sakharov's public statement, reflects a change in the Soviet Union, not a change in Sakharov. What were your reactions when you heard about that?
First of all, I want to say that I was very close with Andrei Sakharov, and I was helping him in his contacts with press in the times when he couldn't use the facilities of Foreign Ministry of Soviet Union to give this press conference. And of course it shows that something changed. But I want to say that in his support of Gorbachev, and in the support of Gorbachev expressed by many Americans, including in the last days even by President Reagan, there is a big difference. He didn't say that all this is bureaucratic. He did say that the system is still very different. And what's more important, he praised Reagan for his efforts, for his criticism, and said that it's very important to continue criticism of the state. And the fact that he mentioned dissidents who are still in prison, and some of them, the only crime of them is that they said some years ago when it wasn't permitted, what Gorbachev says today when it is permitted. And about many of them I write in my book, and they are still in Soviet prison, reminds us that the changes in leadership and the sometimes exciting changes in some or other phenomena in the system doesn't mean the change of the principles of the system. That's why even when we wish that Gorbachev will continue, we must understand that he will go only as far as we in the West will be ready to demand and to press and to struggle and to criticize. And we mustn't think that we can help to Gorbachev's reforms by being silent.
So you really did a lot of reading between the lines?
Yes, of course. I know very well the way how we in Soviet Union have to read the newspapers, interviews, and so on.
In the last few years, you've had to do something that, of course, you really wanted to do, and that is live in freedom. Is coping with freedom after 9 years of imprisonment a challenge? Were there difficulties in coping with freedom when you?
I'd say so. That coming free from the world of Gulag and adjusting yourself to the free Western world and with the attempt to remain free is really not a simple problem, because with the time you notice that you are all the day you are making all kinds of choices which you couldn't make in your previous life. What to drink, what to eat, where to go, what kind of book or newspaper to read, so on and so on. And while in Soviet Gulag you was making every day only one choice between good and evil, to say no or yes to KGB. And then your life was really deep, had some existential depth, and you felt how full it is, how tense it is. And here, lost in all these choices, you suddenly find out that you don't have even time to think, to make some really important choices. And you find out that your life can become more shallow, and as a result, maybe less free. And you also find out that in order to be as free as you were in Soviet prison, you must be ready to say no, not only to your enemies, as it was in Gulag, but sometimes to say no to your friends, each of whom wants part of you. And sometimes to say no to your friend is much more difficult than to say no to your enemy. So all these challenges of the free world, which I have to face every day.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Natan Sharansky, and since his release from prison in the Soviet Union in 1986, he's been living with his wife, Avital, in Israel. He's just written a book about his imprisonment. It's titled Fear No Evil, and it's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with David Wise. He's written extensively about espionage. His new book, The Spy Who Got Away, tells the story of Edward Lee Howard, the first CIA agent to defect to the Soviet Union. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Mark Morris, the outspoken dancer and choreographer who says he doesn't like modern dance that's boring. Apparently, few people find his work boring. He's become one of the most sought-after choreographers in the United States and Europe. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording by Joshua Breakstone, a guitarist in his early 30s who's influenced by jazz of the 1940s. And television critic David Bianculli looks at the midlife crisis of the laugh track. It seems to have run its course on sitcoms, but it's found a new life in commercials. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. South Africa's largest strike ever took place today when black South Africans stayed away from work, protesting new government labor laws and recent crackdowns on anti-apartheid activism. John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Over 2 million people took part in an illegal strike to protest a proposed new law that labor leaders believe may crush many unions and roll back the advances made by the union movement over the last 20 years. Employers who had threatened to dismiss workers and cancel recognition agreements with unions did not act on those threats. In 4 separate incidents, bombs went off on railway lines, apparently to stop commuter traffic in sympathy with the strike. And in a 5th incident, a gasoline bomb was thrown into a bus, injuring 5 people. Black townships like Soweto were heavily patrolled by police, and soldiers were on standby. But the police did not intervene, and the strike is expected to continue for 2 more days. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
The Philippine Senate today formally passed a bill banning nuclear weapons from Philippine ports or soil. The No Nukes legislation passed on a 19-3 vote. Supporters say the measure is aimed at 6 U.S. installations where nuclear weapons are believed stored. The bill's chief sponsor says it will force the U.S. to respect the Philippine Constitution, which prescribes a policy of freedom from nuclear weapons. The U.S. consistently refuses to comment on whether it has nuclear arsenals in the Philippines, but opposes any bans on nuclear loads on board its ships and planes. President Reagan continues his public relations campaign on his summit meeting with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. The president today delivered his 3rd appraisal of the summit in the past 4 days. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The president looked well rested as he addressed a natural gas industry group with delegations from 45 nations, including the Soviet Union. He spoke of his talks with Gorbachev and with Soviet citizens, from strollers on Red Square to students at Moscow University and monks at a monastery. The president seemed pleased that he was able to press for human rights right on the soil of the country he once called the evil empire. President Reagan said visiting Moscow on behalf of the American people was one of the highest privileges of his life. He said the greatest significance was not that he spoke there.
I was only giving voice to the abiding beliefs of the American people, indeed of free people everywhere. No, it was that the words that were spoken were words of faith, words of freedom, words of truth.
The president concluded by saying, "Unarmed truth is irresistible." I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
While the president stressed the improvements in U.S.-Soviet relations, Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci today warned that Soviet social reforms have not reduced the Kremlin's military threat. Speaking to Japan's National Press Club in Tokyo, Carlucci stressed the need to protect the United States' technological advantage over the Soviets. He also urged Japan to take on a greater share of its own defense burden. Carlucci is in Japan to brief Japanese leaders about President Reagan's summit meeting last week in Moscow. The Senate has given final approval to a record $1.1 trillion federal budget for fiscal year 1989, which begins October 1st. The spending plan includes extra funds for the fight against illegal drugs, as well as more money for space exploration, AIDS research, and education. The compromise meets a military spending ceiling of $299.5 billion. The productivity of American industry increased at a revised annual rate of 3.6% in the first 3 months of this year. The Labor Department had said earlier that the key measure of economic efficiency moved ahead by less than 1%. The department said that the revision was larger than usual because of changes in the gross national product figures. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 4 points to close at 2075.21. Advances led declines 4-3. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from guitarist Joshua Breakstone. When he was in college, Breakstone played rock and roll, but then moved into straight-ahead jazz. The first jazz musicians to make an impression on him were trumpet players like Lee Morgan, Clifford Brown, and Donald Byrd, and their playing left its mark on his sound.
Guitarist Joshua Breakstone is a young 32 years old, but as a stylist, he's a throwback. His muffled sound and horn-like conception are rooted in the 1940s. Breakstone is a conservator of older values, a point reinforced by the company he keeps on his new album, Evening Star, on Contemporary. Trombonist Jimmy Knepper and pianist Tommy Flanagan first made their names in the 50s, Knepper with Charles Mingus and Flanagan recording Giant Steps with John Coltrane. Drummer Keith Copeland and bassist Dave Shapiro round out the quintet. Evening Star was recorded in one day last December. The band warmed up with Jerome Kern's standard, The Way You Look Tonight. Perhaps fired up by too much morning coffee, Breakstone knocked off a long, goofy solo I'll play for you in a minute. It exemplifies the fine art of interpolation, working in quotations from other tunes that fit a solo's underlying chords. In less than 3 minutes, he quotes from more than half a dozen tunes, from the French class favorite Sur le Pont d'Avignon to Bringing in the Sheaves. Now, other improvisers can squeeze more quotes into an improvisation, but Breakstone's solo has remarkable structural logic. He balances the development of purely musical motifs against a series of running gags. Here's Joshua Breakstone on The Way You Look Tonight. Thank you. Saxophonist Lester Young used to say that a soloist should tell a little story, musically speaking. But Breakstone's interpolations give the phrase new meaning. It's as if, gazing into his beloved's eyes one night, he had a jumbled vision of their future. The Here Comes the Bride wedding, the honeymoon in Avignon, the arrival of a rockabye baby, and a return to the 9-to-5 drudgery of bringing in those sheaves. You can push such an extra musical reading only so far. It beats me how Dixie fits in. But the point is that none of us hears music in a vacuum. We bring a ton of cultural associations to any listening experience, so musicians may as well exploit them. And yet, Breakstone plays as if the last 40 years of pop music barely exist. You'd think he'd never even heard of rock, which introduced a whole new range of possibilities for electric guitar. Evening Star may be a little too straight ahead. No matter how many jokes Breakstone cracks on The Way You Look Tonight, pianist Flanagan is too discreet to be drawn into the comedy. Jimmy Nepper is a fine trombonist, but on this date his lines become a blur on the high-speed chases. His lips lag behind his brain. Quibbles aside, though, Breakstone's retro music wears well because he keeps his sense of humor. With so many young conservatives sounding downright sour, a couple of chuckles offer sweet relief.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Joshua Breakstone's new album, Evening Star, on the Contemporary label. This is Fresh Air. At 31, Mark Morris has become one of the most commissioned choreographers in the United States. Arlene Croce in the New Yorker magazine described him as an innovator and a traditionalist, a satirist and a romantic, and one can never tell in advance what side of him will be presented in any given work or at any given moment in a work. Morris has won a Guggenheim and a Bessie Award for his choreography, and he's choreographed more than 50 dances for his own modern company and for others such as the Boston Ballet, the Joffrey Ballet, and the American Ballet Theatre. Morris choreographs to a lot of different kinds of music, ranging from Vivaldi and Handel to new music and country rock. I asked him if there was a style that united his different dances.
The style of what I do comes from one of the very first pieces I made up when I was about 15, and I think that's probably the only dance I ever made up, and I just keep revising it and rethinking it. I think that I approach every piece from a different point of view, but I certainly I have favorite modes of expression. I have favorite moves, so I suppose that defines a style, although it's hard for me to analyze it personally.
So what was this dance like that you did when you were 15?
Oh, it was fabulous.
Oh, I'll bet.
it was called Barstow, and it's to a piece of Harry Parch's.
Uh-huh.
It was very small bits of dancing that were sort of character pieces, demi-character, I guess. If we were speaking ballet, we would say that. And it was the first time that I'd really sort of tested my voice and made up something that I later found out was modern dance.
One of the solo pieces I've seen you do is called Jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me to be a piece that works on two levels, that on the one hand, there's a lot of serious emotion expressed in it, and on the other hand, there's humor in it as well.
You know, it's like at a funeral or something where suddenly someone has to laugh because it's too much to take. And that's, you know, that's always there. I didn't make the dance up as a joke. I made it up as jealousy. And I found the inspiration, if I have to use a word like that, for the piece from Handel's incredible music and from my personal experiences of jealousy. So people see different things, and it doesn't matter really what I mean. If someone gets another story from one of my dances, it doesn't matter to me. As far as I'm concerned, it was completely a humorless piece.
Okay. do you choreograph differently for yourself than for others?
Well, lately, most of my solos or parts that I have in duets or trios have been choreographed on someone else, and then I learn it from that person. So
you choreograph it and then you learn it from them?
Mm-hmm. Very often.
Explain why it has to be that way. Why? How come you choreograph it and you don't already know it yourself?
Well, because I make it up. You know, I make it up as I go along. And I want to see the piece formally. And mm-hmm. I want to see that it makes sense as a complete dance. I mean, I know what it is and I know all the steps because I've made them up. But it's impossible, for example, to see myself in a large group dance because someone has to be watching. And the person watching should be the choreographer. And that's me. So it gets complicated. Just because it feels good to do doesn't mean it looks good to watch.
Let's talk about how you started to dance. What was the first experience that you had watching dance that really excited you about it?
The first concert experience of watching dance was the Jose Greco Dance Company when I was about 8, I think, in Seattle. And Jose Greco and Nana Lorca, who was actually a superior dancer, came to Seattle frequently, and my mother was nutty about Spanish dance, and so we went to see it, and I knew that that's what I wanted to do right away.
So you started studying flamenco dance after that?
Yeah, that was my first thing. I did a year or so of just doing Spanish dance, and then I added things like ballet and some sort of modern dance at that time.
You know, it's funny. I think of flamenco dancing as having a lot of sexual bravado to it. And here you were, a kid of around, what, 9 or something? Learning
yes.
it. Did it make any sense to you?
Of course. Do not children have sexual bravado?
Well, actually, yes, actually.
It just isn't called that yet, I guess.
It's also a dance of another culture.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, it was, I guess, exotic enough to appeal to me. And, you know, I continue to be very, very interested in ethnic dance forms, although I'm less involved personally as a participant. I love to watch those things. I love Indian dance. I love Asian dance, actually, of all kinds. And, you know, I've had a lot of experience with various Balkan points of view in dancing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the dances that you mentioned are popular dances, or folk dances of one form or another. Do you think that it shaped your sensibility in a way to start dance doing you know, folk dances as opposed to high art type dances, you know, where you have to study for a lifetime before you can, you know, master it?
Well, to do any dance, to be a master at any form of dance requires a lifetime of study that never stops. So just because they're, you know, lowly ethnic forms doesn't mean that they're not sophisticated or important. And I think that that's a big mistake, that people view, you know, giant megalithic ballet companies with giant budgets as the important thing in the dance world, and I think that that's exactly wrong. You know, I was drawn to folk dance, as it's called, because of a particular communal spirit, a community spirit, that everybody, you know, babies and antiques all do these same dances that are part of an important cultural activity, an important, like, part of life.
You moved to New York and joined several companies. Once you started your own company, after you started to get established in New York, you moved back to Seattle, where you were from. Why did you leave New York?
Because it's gross. It's just that I was tired of living in New York and just eating rice and beans and living in, you know, a dump. So I moved back to Seattle, where I continued to eat rice and beans and lived in a little bit better dump and worked at the university for a while. But then, you know, I was getting so much more work for the company and for me, through commissions and things, that I really was spending much less time in Seattle. I was splitting the time between New York and Seattle, and then it turned into one-third New York, one-third Seattle, and the rest of the time on tour, you know, traveling all over. So, you know, I sort of am nomadic.
Well, now you're about to go to Brussels.
That's right.
Do you think that it's that life for a dance company is going to be very different there than you're used to in the States?
Absolutely, radically totally. You know, it's a tired old thing that I always say, that in the States, art is mostly luxurious, and in Europe it's mostly necessary. And I think that it's a whole point of view that is incomprehensible to the majority of Americans, who, you know, think that the theater is just highbrow and just for, you know, highfalutin types. And I think that that's a real, real big problem.
Will you be doing operas when you go to Europe?
Yeah, probably. I'm negotiating. I haven't decided yet exactly what's going to happen. I'm interested in doing Baroque opera.
Yeah, you've been doing some opera in the States. You recently did Nixon in China. You choreographed that.
Yeah, I choreographed that, and then most recently I directed Die Fledermaus for Seattle Opera, which was a hoot.
A hoot, really?
Yeah, it was very fun. It's a funny piece, and it turned out very well.
Why did you want to get into opera?
Because I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the best music ever composed is operatic music. You know, not necessarily our Puccinis and our Verdis. Every note was fabulous, but I like to go back a little farther to, you know, Handel and Mozart. And it's music, you know, it's very important work. And I think too often it's done with bad singing and bad direction. So, you know, I've worked with Peter Sellers, and I intend to do more of that in the future, because he's like the smartest, most musical director I've ever encountered.
So what are you doing right now to get ready for Brussels?
Well, I go there a lot. I'm going there next week for some meetings and stuff. I'm trying to better my French, and I have great fear of having to learn Flemish, but I think that'll be all right. We're having a lot of time off this summer, so the dancers can come to terms with leaving the country. So it's pretty easy.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best, and thanks very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Choreographer and dancer Mark Morris. He leaves on September 1st for Belgium, where he and his troupe become the national company in residence. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What you got for us?
Tonight we have a profile of a 67-year-old Israeli woman who was born and still lives on Israel's oldest kibbutz. She remembers a time when relations between Palestinians and Jews were almost what you could call amicable. And she's watched the evolution of attitudes in Israel since the 1920s, and she'll tell us about that tonight. Also, the Philippine Senate today passed an anti-nuclear bill that, if it passes the House and becomes law, will make it extremely difficult for the U.S. to operate military bases there. And director Alan Rudolph tells us what he's listening to in the way of music when he's not making movies.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli has been watching TV with his eyes closed lately. He says some of what he hears is appealing, but some of it is appalling.
Okay, everybody, it's time for another TV pop quiz. Listen to these short scenes from three different TV series and figure out what they have in common. Identifying the specific programs earns bonus points, but isn't really necessary. Ready? Here we go.
And I'm telling you, everybody gets to at least second base by the seventh grade.
This was a lot of pressure. Especially since most of the girls we knew had no second bases.
The problem is, we'd need your restaurant for two full days. You'd have to completely shut down your normal business.
Well, look, I'd like to help you out here, but 2 days, that's tough. That's very tough.
You understand, we'd pay you to use your place.
How much?
Well, 2 days, two nights, $8,000.
You want to use the restaurant or buy it?
What is it?
We're out of tea, but we have some mayonnaise.
Ah, well, how about a big spoonful of mayonnaise?
Oh, we don't have any spoons.
For the extra credit fanatics, those clips were from ABC's The Wonder Years, CBS's Frank's Place, and NBC's The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. But I'm more interested in the common thread, which is this. All of those shows set out to make you laugh, but don't use laugh tracks. It's a wonderful trend, but there's already reason to fear that the trend may have peaked. Many of the so-called dramedies, dramas mixed with comedy, won't be back next fall, and most of the new half-hour shows on the network schedules are standard sitcoms complete with laugh tracks. But wait, it gets worse. Just as programs without laugh tracks are starting to disappear, commercials with laugh tracks are starting to show up. Listen to this ad for Ragu Spaghetti Sauce, which looks and sounds like a 1960s sitcom.
I'm relaxed.
She's here. Relax.
Carol, you're an angel. I won't be a bother. Oh, Michael, bring me that bag.
What's in here?
It's an old Italian custom. You move in, you bring sauce.
You make your own spaghetti sauce?
Are you kidding? She makes the greatest sauce in the world. She lives in the kitchen.
You do? Oh, not anymore. But I still make the great sauce. I think your mom and I are going to get along just fine.
Now, laugh track or not, that's not funny. I haven't hated a TV commercial this much since Nike used the Beatles song Revolution to try and sell sneakers. I don't want laugh tracks on my programs, much less during the commercials. Laugh tracks are loud and insulting and brain dead, but they're worse than that. In terms of true comedy, they're the coward's way out. When you slap a laugh track on something, it doesn't matter if it's funny or not. It's presto, instant comedy. Now, granted, some commercials deserve laugh tracks, like the one where Kelly LeBrock asks us not to hate her because she's beautiful. Hey, Kelly, I don't hate you because you're beautiful. I hate you because you're conceited. Say, wait a minute. Maybe this canned laughter stuff isn't so bad after all. Give me a laugh track. And take my wife, please.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with rock star Joan Jett. She's been described as the toughest, grittiest, hardest-working woman in rock. And she got rave reviews co-starring with Michael J. Fox in the film Light of Day. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the Flamin' Groovies, a band that fought all the trends in the late 60s by putting out three-minute pop songs with anti-drug lyrics. And book critic John Leonard will review the new collection of essays by gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistance from Deborah Beagle, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton, who also directed today's show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.